Brackshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio, where you listen with your ears and not your mouth.
Good evening and welcome to Wandsworth Radio. You are listening to the Blackshaw Arts Hour. We're here again. We're talking about all things theatre. We'll do a movie review. We've got an exciting interview with the writer of the production that we just saw go up live yesterday. And in the studio with me this evening is Matt, our regular movie reviewer.
Hello.
And Ellie.
Hello. Well, you didn't. I thought you were going to give me a title, and then you didn't.
Oh, sorry.
That's fine.
I didn't think I needed to.
You can take some time to think about what you want to call me, and then you can release it.
Ellie Pitkin, who needs no introduction.
Yeah. That's,
oh, well, I'm suitably ego-flattered now.
So, Alice happened yesterday. We're all very pleased with how it went yesterday, aren't we?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it was a fantastic day. Matt, you saw it as well as an audience member.
I did. I very much enjoyed it.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah,
it'd be really awkward if you were like, I have some critiques that I want to air later in the show.
It's right, I only review
Ellie
the movies.
Ellie punches Matt in the face. Show's over. Yeah, so the first thing that we are going to be going into this evening is this.
The Matt Boothman Film Review. So good, I put my trousers back on.
Matt. I don't think you told us what you were going to be doing this week, last week.
I did tell you what I was going to be doing, but I forgot the title last week's show, so I never actually said the title, which is The Falling.
Ah, so profesh you are.
I know, absolutely. So this is The Falling, which is by writer-director Carol Morley. Uh-huh. It's a BFI production, British Film Institute. So it's set in 1969, just as Free Love is kind of going out of fashion. We're going out of the 60s into the 70s. Set in a sort of idyllic, leafy English village. It's a proper host of homegrown British film, all about Britain, set in Britain. Set in a strict, really kind of strict girls' school in this idyllic, leafy village. They're all at the age where they're just sort of heading into teenagerhood, heading into puberty, so hormones absolutely everywhere. And in the middle of that, we have Lydia, played by Maisie Williams, who you may know from Game of Thrones as Arya Stark. So she sort of ends up seizing the lead role in this movie. So it doesn't seem from the beginning of the movie that she's going to be the main character. She starts off... she's ignored at home, pretty much, by her mum, played by Maxine Peake.
Oh, I love a bit of Maxine.
She's fantastic. And she does so much with so little in this, because she's essentially playing a shut-in. She provides for her children by cutting hair, because that's a job that she doesn't have to, she never has to leave the house to do it. People come to her to have their hair cut. And she's a very sort of closed-off character. So not a very nice environment for Lydia, Maisie Williams' character, to be growing up with that kind of closed off character as a mother. And at school, Lydia is in the shadow of her best friend, Abby, played by Florence Pugh, who I've not seen anything before, but she's very good in this. Who is the kind of the more charismatic half of the best friend pair. She's the one who's already kind of pursuing boys and getting interested in that sort of thing. But very early on in the film, a thing happens to Abby, and Lydia kind of takes centre stage. The thing that happens, Lydia is the only witness to it, and it begins with Abby fainting in quite a dramatic way.
Mm-hmm.
And... soon after this, Lydia starts fainting in classes, in assemblies, in a similarly sort of dramatic way, and becomes patient zero for a kind of fainting epidemic. All the other girls in the school start fainting as well, kind of at random points.
Sounds like mass hysteria.
Yeah, so that is kind of the interesting mystery to this. So Maisie Williams is excellent in it. And kind of shows a little bit more of her range than you get. So she's already playing sort of a non-stereotypical character for a girl her age in Game of Thrones.
Yes.
Yeah.
She brings that same kind of... she's very intense in this. She's very kind of defiant in this. She reminded me a little bit of Ezra Miller in We Need to Talk About Kevin.
Oh, yeah.
In the way that she sort of, she looks authority figures in the, right in the eye with this kind of, I dare you to tell me that I'm faking this, just as she's about to keel over.
Right.
So she this kind of proves she can do that kind of intense defiance without actually playing a cold-blooded murderous character.
Yes, like without having a sword in her hand.
Yes, exactly. So what we get from there is this, it plays out as kind of a mystery. Where is it? What is this fainting? What is the deal with this fainting? What is the deal with Lydia?
Headline, what is the deal with this fainting?
Yeah.
Like that coughing thing that everyone used to do when we had a substitute teacher. You know, did you guys do that? Someone starts coughing and then by the end of it, everyone's coughing in the
Absolutely,
class.
Absolutely, yeah. I don't know about in school. It would definitely happen in university when we ought to have been a bit more grown up in lectures. But that is one of the key questions of it. Is this just all of these girls defying authority? Because it's a very strict school, it's got all these strict rules about skirt length and behaviour and all these sorts of things. And is this just all of them standing up and doing something that the rules can't govern? Mm-hmm. You know, they can't be punished for this because it appears to be a medical thing.
Yeah.
Are they faking it? Is she faking it? But if she's faking it, then how come everybody else starts doing it? Is it kind of a mass hallucination? Is it kind of a the power of suggestion that because she appears to be ill, everybody else thinks they're getting it? Is it her trying to sort of tribute or memorialise her friend it by sort of fainting in that same very theatrical way every time? Or is it more of a power play, like trying to overthrow
the school.
Well, it starts spreading to the teachers as well, which is where the question gets even deeper.
I really want to know the answer. Do you find out the answer in the film?
It has quite a satisfying, it doesn't wrap everything up. It doesn't give you a full explanation to everything that happens, but it does give you enough of an explanation to be satisfying.
Okay.
Is about all I can say without spoilers.
Because I really hate films that there's one massive mystery at the heart of it, and then at the end they're like, so have fun working out whether that was true or not. Yeah. Bye. And I'm like, well, no, I'm very angry.
Yeah,
I'm
it doesn't so do that.
Good, okay.
You'll be pleased to know. So the other suggestion is this somehow related to sex and sexual awakening? Because kind of what coincides with this fainting epidemic is all the girls involved in the fainting also starting to get more interested in kind of makeup and doing their hair and becoming more kind of performing sexuality and becoming
such
more attractive.
Symbolism.
I know. and also at the same time, there's some really quite uncomfortable sexual stuff going on in Lydia's home life, which is largely happening as a result of her sort of not having a very active parent in the household.
Right.
And so those scenes were things that I thought they were well done and kind of sensitively done. They were clearly kind of putting off some of the other people in the theatre
really?
That I saw it.
Noticeably.
Well, only in that there were people tittering and there were people...
Oh, uncomfortable
kind of,
giggles.
Well, uncomfortable giggles and sort of reacting in a kind of ridiculing it kind of way. Like,
right.
Oh, really? Kind of that, that kind of reaction.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it kind of teeters. Your mileage will vary whether you think, oh, that is just a step too far. I don't really believe it anymore, or whether you'll be like, oh, like I was made very uncomfortable by it, but in a way that I think was intentional on the part of the film.
So you're buying into
it, working.
But being made uncomfortable.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask about things like that, about whether there are things in films that kick you out immediately or that are deal breakers for you in a film. Like if you hear that a certain element or thing is in a film, will you not see it?
I don't have one specifically for myself. I will probably sit through anything. Like I think we were talking before this about Antichrist, which is a Lars von Trier film, which is pretty horrific, has genital mutilation stuff, just pretty heavy scenes. And I sat through that and I was like, well, you know, that was well done. It was a well put together film, and it was, you know, at times troublesome in terms of what you're watching, but I don't have one at all, I don't think.
I have a very specific one. When it turns out to be aliens, I get really angry.
I get that.
I mean, I'm a massive fan of anything that has a mystery. I'm a big fan of procedural crime dramas. I enjoy any kind of like supernatural mystery, and there have been several films, two I can think of, Jeepers Creepers, which started off as a pretty good psychological sort of thriller slash horror story, you know, of its genre, so not really high art, but an enjoyable film, until it got to, I mean, sorry, spoilers, but it is like 15 years old.
Yeah, no, if you've not seen it now, you
don't bother, because because about half an hour into it, you find out that what you think is this really creepy, either supernatural or just, you know, twisted human being that is the main predator, turns out to be a big alien thing.
Yeah, and no, I was explanation. Like,
this was not what I signed up for. And similarly, the ending to... well,
is it
not
Knowing?
Really,
the Nick Cage...
No. I mean, that's a terrible film anyway. Yeah. But the ending... But that's the same, actually. Yes.
Yeah.
The ending to Indiana Jones, the most recent installment... Again, set up as quite a cool mystery, and then it's aliens, and same for
Knowing was fantastic. Knowing. The first half of that film I really enjoyed. Yes. I mean, it was a bit
odd. A Nick Cage film, so I mean, it's of a very specific type.
Yeah,
and I'm a massive fan of Nick Cage, so you know.
Yeah,
but
I thought it was going to be really good. It just absolutely plummeted downhill.
It's set up as a supernatural, spooky mystery. And there's lots of coincidences, and Nick Cage thinks he's cracked the code to the universe and knows when stuff's going to happen. And it seems to be that that is definitely the case. And then it's aliens.
Yeah. They're just walking around outside
of
the apocalypse.
I just feel a lot of the time, like, when it's aliens, it's just that they get really lazy with the script, and they're like, oh, all this cool, mysterious stuff is so mysterious.
We've written ourselves into a hole.
Yes.
How are we going to get ourselves
they
out of it?
They have done the writing equivalent of painting themselves into the corner of a room, and they just go with, well, aliens.
Yeah.
You'll be pleased to know it's not aliens in The Falling.
That's good.
Small spoiler, maybe.
Well,
I'm telling you what it's not, so I'm not going to count that as a spoiler.
Yeah.
Do you have a deal breaker, Matt?
No, I don't think I do.
No? Okay.
No.
You're a patient man.
Yeah. I I'm also the sort of person who will watch something because I don't feel I'm allowed to criticise something until I've actually seen it. So if there's something that I think I'm not going to like, I might still see it anyway, just so that I feel qualified to talk about
it. And if it gets to a point where some people make it to a breaking point for you, you think, well, I'm going to push through, because what if in 10 minutes time it's the best thing I've ever seen?
I completely lied. My deal breaker is obviously space.
but you do see films with space in.
Yeah,
you just complain about it a lot.
Yeah.
So the pacing of The Falling is, it's a bit slow to start. So like I said, you can't really tell who's going to be the main character, who you're supposed to be rooting for, until about sort of 20, 25 minutes in. And a lot of it's hard to see where it's kind of going. Like, there's a lot of scenes that are in there for mood or for atmosphere or for colour rather than to advance the plot. But I really liked all of them. Like, there's a really good little scene between two of the teachers, Ms. Mantell, played by Greta Scacchi, and Monica Dolan plays the headmistress of the school, where they have a little scene that kind of almost precisely mirrors a scene that Lydia and Abby had earlier, which kind of gives you that idea that all the issues that all these girls are facing are they're not as misunderstood as they think by the teachers, because they're still all facing the same kinds of issues. And also the final realization that comes in the last kind of 10 minutes, it comes from that kind of ties everything together. It comes from an unexpected angle, or at least I didn't see it coming. But when you then think back about it after you've come out of the cinema, it is so well set up through all of the little elements that you see. This is one of the things that because you can't really tell what's significant, because it's all kind of meandering everywhere, it's hard to tell what is going to contribute to the ending. But when you get there, you go, oh yes, everything has been scattered throughout this film. So it's a really satisfying ending, I found, that ties everything together. That what is the deal with the fainting? What is the deal with Lydia? What is the deal with her mum? It ties everything together. I found it really, really, a really satisfying movie.
Okay.
Matt's made me want to see it.
Yeah, I want to see it too.
Yeah. Good work, Matt.
My work
You've achieved
here
what you're here for. What are you doing next week, really quick?
So I'm looking at options. So there's what appears to be a sequel to Gareth Edwards' Monsters coming out, which was a movie I really liked, which Gareth Edwards did all the special effects for in his bedroom years ago, which I really liked. So I might try to seek that out. Or there's Far From the Madding Crowd, the new adaptation of the Thomas Hardy book, which I know Ellie's already seen.
I saw it this very day.
Yeah, so I may see that so that we can have a chat about it.
We can.
Week.
Oh, I don't think I could see that. I'm sorry, guys.
That's okay.
I can't physically.
It's not
bring
in space,
my...
but it's a costume drama, so Aisha will not be on board.
I can't deal with that. We are going to quickly jump into our Arts Thing of the Week segment. This is Vicky talking to you about Hayes Festival, a writers' festival up in Wales.
On the 21st of May, a small town in the Welsh Borders will play host to a large number of writers of all walks at this year's Hay Festival, which takes place yearly in the beautiful town of Hay-on-Wye. Now, it's a little far from Wandsworth, but if you fancy a trip out of London for the bank holiday weekend or the half-term holidays, you're a book lover, then look no further. The festival runs until May the 31st, so there are plenty of dates to get down there. The unusual thing about this festival, besides the fact that it's all about writing, I suppose, is that you don't buy a ticket for the festival itself, but for individual events that you want to see, and you can access the main festival site for free. So you can basically create your own festival. It's all incredibly civilised, and there are a number of events that, although ticketed for capacity reasons, are completely free. The prices of tickets for the paid tickets range between £5 and £19, and there's a plentiful family programme. Cressida Cowell of How to Train Your Dragon fame, Jacqueline Wilson and the legendary illustrator Nick Butterworth are just some of the really famous writers and illustrators that will be talking at events and signing books in the designated children's area entitled Hay Fever. Writers across all genres and topics will be speaking at the main festival, including the likes of Mary Portis, Rose Tremaine, Monty Don, David Starkey, Sandy Toksvig and Vikram Seth, to name just a few. So check out the full programme for all the details. Whatever your literary interest, there's bound to be something of interest at Hay. And if the weather's pleasant, fingers crossed, then it's a beautiful sight to spend a couple of days, book events or no. Tickets are still available for a number of events, so if you fancy making the trip this May, you need only visit the website hayfestival.com.
We are back, and that was Vicky talking to us a little bit about the Hayes Festival, which I know you guys are aware of. I've never heard of it until she sent me this Arts Thing of the Week, but I know that you guys have seen writers, and Matt, you're a writer, so you're well into this kind of discussion.
I've always want to go to Hay, and there's always something scheduling wise that gets in my way. It's Hay-on-Wye. It's the Hay Festival rather than the Hayes Festival.
Oh, sorry, mixed that up one.
Yeah, so yes, I'm aware of it, but I've been to Hay, but I haven't been to the Hay Festival.
We were sort of talking a little bit about if you've ever seen, sort of in tying along in the sort of realm of seeing writers. Have you ever seen a writer perform, do a reading or anything? Because I haven't.
And I've been to a few, yeah. So I went to the World Science Fiction and Fantasy Convention last year when it came to London for the first time in ages. So I saw a lot of readings there, mostly in kind of in the genre. So I saw Hanu Rajaniemi was particularly good. And there are kind of regular London events if you feel like seeking them out. There's an organisation, I think they're primarily a blog, but they organise events with kind of writer readings and things as well, called Porno Kitsch.
Oh, yeah.
Don't mistype it, or your you might have unpleasant things in your browser history, but it's pornokitsch.com. They organise things kind of in association with Crake and Rum, with writers reading things, which are always pretty good fun, kind of writers reading with some signing, mm-hmm. and some buying books and some booze, and they're always pretty good fun.
Oh, yeah. Ellie, have you seen a writer that's one of your favourite writers or anything, do a reading?
I haven't seen a writer doing a reading. I've been to various events where there's been kind of writers' discussions, mm-hmm. Which is always interesting. When we were doing our adaptation of Gormenghast a couple of years ago, we went to a lot of events around the centenary of the writer of the original book, Mervyn Peake's birth, and there was a particularly interesting event at the British Library, which had some fantastic actors, Zoe Wanamaker, mm-hmm. was one of them, to do some readings from the original book. And there was a talk by the writer's son, because the writer had died some years before, and that talk from Sebastian Peake was really interesting. And there were lots of writers in attendance, because it's quite a kind of a cult classic book,
yeah.
and has a lot of a lot of its fans are writers. Yeah. So we met quite a few people afterwards, one of which was China Mieville, who's a big fantasy writer. And I was with Vicky, one of our team members, and she's a huge fan, so fangirled out a little bit, which was nice to watch.
Slightly embarrassing.
She held it together while she had a discussion with him, which was very impressive, but afterwards...
And then fainted.
Was, oh, totally. She was, it was very mysterious, actually. She fainted, and then some other people joined in.
Oh, I like what you've done there. I like the sound of this festival. As I said, I've not ever seen a writer do a reading of a book or been to a writer's convention or anything like that. But I like how it's sort of, from what Vicky has said, it sounds like you can curate your festival to your own liking, which is a nice thing to be able to do.
And even when the festival's not on, it's a Hay on Wye is a really nice place to go just for its selection of secondhand bookshops. Mm.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's a literary hub all year round.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, sliding nicely into other writing, our production of Alice in Wonderland is currently on at the Battersea Library in Clapham, and this is an interview with the writer of that production of Alice in Wonderland. His name's Richard Stratton, and this is Helen Johnson interviewing him.
Hello.
Hi, Richard. How do you know Blackshaw?
I have been working with Blackshaw for the entire 5 years of their... Well, I should say our existence, really. It all started when myself and our director, Ellie, were living together with another friend on Blackshaw Road, hence the name. And Ellie wanted to start a theatre company, and she got together some people that might want to help her run a theatre company. And we started and ran a theatre company, and Blackshaw was born. So, I've been with them for 5 years, been involved in pretty much every single performance, and continue to do so.
What's your usual role?
My official role is IT manager, but then I've been involved in writing, and I've been performed in bits and pieces as well. So. I've done a lot of things.
Have you written anything that we might be aware of?
Yes. Well, if you are aware of Blackshaw, you might be aware of it. 2012, we adapted Gormenghast, Titus Groan for the stage, performed at the Actors Church of Covent Garden, and myself and three other writers and an editor worked on that piece. On the adaptation.
Terrific. Okay, so why Alice?
That's a very good question. I know I meant to have a reason, and why Alice really comes back to why it was written in the first place.
Yeah.
And the reason this adaptation was done was because I was working with a youth theatre, the one that I was a member of, up until the age of 18 when I was no longer a youth, so had to leave. And I went back there after university, what was that, many years ago. And they were doing a main show, their kind of big performance of the year. And about 12, I think it was, of their members couldn't be in it, because they were all on the same school trip, and it happened to clash over this kind of half term, whatever it was. And the director of this youth theatre said, "Hey, do you mind? It's only a small job. Do you mind taking these 12 kids and writing something for all of them to be in that will challenge them and allow them to do stuff that we wouldn't usually be able to do in a major performance? And you've got a budget of about £100.
Oh, piece of cake.
Piece of cake.
Excellent.
Oh, and 5 weeks.
Oh.
Yeah. So I had to scramble to think of what on earth I could do with them. Obviously, getting rights to something was kind of out of the question on that budget. And it had to be I had to involve them all. So finding something already written would have been... That fit the cast would have been really hard, so I decided, fine, I'll write something and fit it to the people that I have. And I wanted to do stuff that I wanted to do things that they wouldn't be used to, so multi-rolling and kind of more physical stuff that generally you don't get in the kind of musical theatre that the youth theatre kind of specialised in. And I wanted to give them a chance to be able to direct stuff themselves, so I wanted it to be kind of a simple and a story that they already knew, so they wouldn't need to tackle with the story and learn the story. They could jump right into it and go, okay, I know the story, I know the characters, they're familiar to me, so I can perform and direct them and as well. So that was kind of what I decided I needed, and I've always been a massive fan of Alice in Wonderland. It's an incredible book, incredible story. And I honestly can't remember why it popped into my head as something that would be good. I seem to remember I had a few options, and I sat down with the 12 kids that I was working with, and I said, okay, there are these few. Which one stands out to you guys the most? And we talked through it and discussed which one would be most fun to do and one that they were most into. And Alice came out on top. I think that's how it went. This is awful, isn't it? I can't remember.
It's fine. So you hadn't written anything before that particularly?
I'd written a few things. I studied playwriting at university, so there was plenty of writing with that. I also studied adapting fiction, so there was that as well. So there was, I had experience writing. There were mostly shorter things. Nothing that had been, I guess, fully staged at that point. Not a full play, at least. Kind of scenes and sketches and bits and pieces, yes. And I've written lots of things that are still on the hard drive somewhere, mm-hmm. gathering digital dust. But that was the first thing that ended up being performed publicly.
Okay. Can you talk us through the adaptation process from that point, maybe? So when you and the kids decided that it should be Alice, what happened then? What did you do then?
We decided that Alice would be it, and then I had 2 weeks to write it. And then we started rehearsals. So although the decision of what it was had input from the kids, the adaptation, unfortunately, I couldn't get as much input as perhaps at the time I wanted from them. But I think that worked out well because it allowed me just to like throw stuff in that maybe they wouldn't be sure about, or you know, they were, oh, that might be too challenging. I was able to throw whatever I wanted at them and kind of by doing that and expecting them to succeed, which was really cool.
That's great. I think that shows in the script, really, though. There's a lot of different techniques, aren't there, with the puppetry and the weird stuff with the doors.
Yeah, I wanted to try and do something different with each scene, a different technique or a different... something that they wouldn't be used to. Like, in the original version, the caterpillar was made up of three actors, one saying the lines and then the other two provided more arms and legs with either their own arms and legs or other items and props to kind of create them. So that was really fun to do because there was they got to work together as a team without being able to see one another. They had to start feeling of how their arms would use, and it kind of ended up created this quite a kind of these weird arms that at one point could all be working very much together, and then at another point would actually fight one another for possession of a particular item. I think we had him smoking, the pipe from the book, and at the end there was a fight over which hand could hold that, and mm-hmm. and so they suddenly had these lives of their own. And there were other scenes, and you mentioned the door and what we did with that. Well, don't want to give too much away, people
Fair enough.
To come and see that. But yeah, there was a lot of opportunities to do different things.
Okay, so how has the play changed since Blackshaw got their mitts on it?
This is the second time Blackshaw have done it. We did it last year, again, part of WAF. And we did it in a different space. And that, the script was the same as it was when I first did it with the Youth Theatre. Bar a few changes that I made, bits and pieces that I was never 100% happy with but didn't have time to change. So the Tweedledee and Tweedledum scene was altered. Actually, that was rewritten. I didn't realise. Yeah, the majority of that was actually rewritten. So that's changed. And I think that was... I was able to change that because there are certain things you can do with, you can be sure will definitely work with professional actors, you know, with a lot of experience and adult actors, that you, it's not that the kids wouldn't be able to do it, they would, but I don't think they'd have been able to do it in the time they had to rehearse. And I, although while I wanted to challenge them, I didn't want to set them up to fail. So I was very conscious about how successful they could be within the rehearsal time that we had. And because of that, I didn't do what I wanted to do with Tweedledee and Tweedledum, because I didn't think we'd be able to get it to a point where, essentially, where I wouldn't want to put them on stage with not feel like they had done the best they could.
Of course. How do you feel about that scene now?
I think it really works. I'm pleased with it.
Do you think maybe it's been written so it's a tad too complicated? A little bird told me there was a particularly ridiculous rehearsal.
Yeah, there are some horrible lines.
Who has to say those horrible lines?
I have to say those horrible lines, seeing as I'm also in it this time. And you know what? It's not just kids that will struggle with some of it. Everyone can struggle with it.
I'm sure the kids will understand it and enjoy it, though, and it will be worth yours and Alex's efforts to get your mouths around it.
Yes, absolutely. It makes sense in the context of Wonderland.
Great.
And that's the wonderful thing. Some of these lines, you don't have, like, they don't need to make sense. You've just got to understand that they don't. And
that could be right out of the book, what you just said.
Yeah, it's the wonderful logic of Wonderland. All you've got to do is realise that one of the characters aren't making sense. And that is enough.
So you're enjoying being in the cast?
Yes. I'm loving it. It's really great. We've got a good portion of the guys that were in it last year coming back to do something. We've got a couple of guys that were in another play we did last year. So everybody knows one another. And so everyone's kind of been able to jump in quite, very, very well. It's all going swimmingly.
Great. So... how is it having Ellie direct you in something that you were directing other people in once upon a time?
Well, it's fine. I mean, it's very different. Obviously, Ellie's... Actually, the weirdest thing is, right, I wrote it with a very clear vision of how it was going to be directed, because I knew rehearsals would be limited. So as I was writing, I was making stage directions that were really just for me. They were essentially reminders of how I was going to do it. And, like, at this point, I never thought it would ever be performed outside. I thought it would be done, and then that will kind of be it. So that remained, and it's really fun to see some of those stage directions in it. And actually, for this round, I went through and I deleted most of them and have just put very general directions, what you'd more expect from a script rather than kind of a Pickett-esque specificity that I originally wrote in, and it's really interesting to see what was in the script that I just didn't realise was there, because I've had such a clear idea of it would be like this, and I knew I knew the cast I was going to have, for example. You know, you don't get that when you write a play. You don't know exactly who the cast are and their sizes and temperaments and how they move and their voice. Like, I knew all of that, so it was incredibly tailor-made. So when Blackshaw first did it, I was super excited to see how this, what I saw, kind of tailor-made play was going to end up once it had been put with, you know, in a completely different scenario with different actors and different director who had no idea how it was originally written. And it's brilliant. So much more has come out of it. It's amazing how much, actually. It's really great. And of course, as a writer, you get to sit there very smug and pretend that, of course, you wrote all those jokes in, and that was absolutely your intention.
well done.
So yeah, exactly. You get to pretend that you're much funnier than you actually are.
And so the script has moved on again now. Those edits that you mentioned took place because the play is going to be in a library this time around.
Yes, it is. So the original, my original idea for it, was that it would be set in a junk shop, and the premise was that Alice has lost her cat, and she's wandering around town putting up, you know, lost posters for her cat. She goes into a junk shop to ask to put up a poster, gets locked in, magic things happen, she ends up in Wonderland, and Wonderland is essentially built out of the shop. So the characters would pick up junk and make stuff out of them. And that was another thing that, again, I want to do with the kids, try and, you know, rather than in most plays they were doing where they would, everything would be, you know, if you had some flowers, for example, on stage, what you would see would be flowers. You know, they would have props that were unambiguously flowers. Whereas in this version, it would be made of junk. And so we were looking at representation of things. So nothing was, there was no literal representation of the things that they were or the things that they were using. It was all stuff made of junk, which was really cool fun. And that sort of premise came across, was used in Blackshaw's version as well. So going into a library, we have a lot of fun of being able to play more on the literary side of that and doing a similar thing. But it's, everything comes out of a library now, which of course creates a very different feel, and allows you to do different things than playing with junk.
Well, yeah, we heard from Zara on a previous show, and it sounds like she's really gone to town with it. It's going to be really exciting to see what it looks like this time. You're enjoying being in this version of Alice?
I am, very much.
Good. What's your favourite scene in this version? Is it one that you're in, or is it maybe something else you've seen?
I don't know. I always like the Mad Hatter's Tea Party, simply because the characters are just ridiculous. Out of all of the characters in Wonderland, they are possibly the most mad. And that scene was so much fun to write because I got to take all of my favourite bits from that part of the book and then add in a few of my own little things and kind of make, I guess it's kind of like the greatest hits of the Mad Hatter scene in my mind. You know, these are all the bits I really liked. So that's really good fun.
Is this the first time you've been in Alice in Wonderland?
No, it's not. I ended up being in one of the performances that we did with the Youth Theatre. We did an initial run, and then we were asked to come along and do it in another theatre on the Isle of Wight, which was where the Youth Theatre was. And for that second time, it was just a one-off performance. For that second time, one of our actors, she couldn't make it, and so I stood in became was part of the cast, which was good fun. I ended up being a walrus, a soldier, and part of the door for that, which is the same parts, actually, I'm playing this time round, which was a bit of a coincidence. It seems history repeating. One of our actors that we asked to come back couldn't be in it, sadly. So I ended up jumping in again. This time I get the added bonus of being the walrus as well, though. So, yeah, this is the second time I did it. So I kind of stood out a bit the first time, being with people that were very much... my junior, which I think added an extra kind of level on it. So this time I don't stand out quite so much.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, tell us about your first theatrical experience.
As in performing or just seeing something?
Whichever.
The first thing I remember seeing was a village pantomime in New Church School Hall, where I was currently going, and my granddad was in it, and it was Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves, and he was playing Ali Baba, but in this version, Ali Baba wasn't like the lead, there was another character who ended up being like the hero, and Ali Baba's role was to be turned into a camel, because of the curse of the tomb he broke into. So I was watching this show, and I was sat on my chair, and my granddad was up on stage, and I was really enjoying myself and seeing my granddad. And then all of a sudden, my granddad was turned into a camel, and I was very upset.
Oh, dear.
And I hid under my chair. And I had to be taken backstage at half time? What am I talking about? At the interval. So my granddad could say, it's okay, I'm not a camel.
That's a great story.
I was like three. Oh. So I remember once I had gotten over the fact that my granddad was a camel, thinking how cool it was that you could do that. There's something about, you know, creating this other world and letting other people like step into it and lose themselves in it, that was very cool. As a three-year-old, I definitely did not have that exact thought, but it started there. And the next year, I was a bat in their next year's pantomime.
Perfect. Well, it sounds like we are in incredibly safe hands to be guided around Wonderland. So thank you very much, Richard Stratton.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Blackshaw Arts Hour. You are listening to Matt, Ellie and Aisha. We're in the studio. That was just a interview with the writer of Alice in Wonderland, Richard Stratton.
Yes, he's adapted from Lewis Carroll's original, and it's the 150th anniversary year of the book being published, which is very exciting. Not, as Matt said while we were listening to that interview, the 150th centenary.
We would be far, far in the future if that was the case.
So far, I had amazing visions of Lewis Carroll writing alongside the dinosaurs. And then Aisha didn't realise until just now that there's a new Jurassic Park film on the cards. And
see, what I make for the up in sort of my hatred of space, I bring to the table in my love of dinosaur and Jurassic Park movies.
Yeah. So we've made Aisha very happy.
Yeah.
I see a group outing in the future.
Absolutely.
Oh, yes. Love dinosaurs.
So... Alice in Wonderland, adapted by Richard Stratton, is being performed by us as part of the Wandsworth Arts Fringe, which started on Friday the 1st, and we attended the launch party.
Yes, we did. It was very exciting.
It was a lovely venue.
I got to leave work early, which was a bonus.
Yep, Aisha arrived excited for that fact, and then realised there was free canapés, and the day just got much better.
Oh, yeah. And two of you live-tweeted it as well, so if you scroll back through at Blackshaw Update on Twitter, back through the timeline,
you can go back in time.
Yes, you can. And we met lots of fantastic people, other people participating as artists in the Fringe. And Aisha, you've got a couple of flyers from friends that you've met.
Yes, I made some friends, one of which was not the plant pot that was moving around squirting people with water.
There was interactive new age art in the form of a giant plant pot that was sort of
rolling about.
Moving about of its own free will, seemingly, and squirted water at people indiscriminately. And I just got quite annoyed because it made my shoes wet, which was an inconvenience. But I mean, it was funny.
It was very funny.
And I was being grumpy.
It was well done because you couldn't actually tell who was controlling it. So no. Someone had a controller and was rolling this beast of a thing about.
And they could make it talk as well.
So there wasn't anyone inside it.
It wasn't a Dalek situation.
Well, it wasn't a torture device for a small person.
No,
or a child
or a large person. But it was some fun interactive. Art.
I think it said goodbye to our Alice on the way out, and she was quite terrified.
And it then struggled to get up the ramp to exit, which was possibly the favourite part of the evening.
So it was a bit like a Dalek then.
Yes, that actually did spark a conversation about Daleks, and we said that it was actually less dangerous than even the old Daleks, because even the old Daleks could manage a ramp. So,
well, in our evening, I experienced the pot plant. I got to pat a dog, which is, you know, that's a highlight.
Not associated with the pot plant, I'd like to point out.
No. And I also spoke to a lovely guy who gave me a flyer for an upcoming production. It's sort of a duo of Shakespeare. It's Macbeth and the Comedy of Errors, performed on separate nights. And you might have heard of these guys, but they are called the Handlebards. And
it's clever.
I'm not entirely sure. I thought, when I was talking to this guy, who actually isn't in the production, he was just flyering for them, because the guys that do the shows were in Zimbabwe at the time, which is,
of course,
not a traditional holiday destination.
I'm always there.
Yeah. So is
that within the Wandsworth borough? Or?
It is a big borough, Matt, but it does not spread to Zimbabwe, I'm afraid.
Matt knows geography. So these guys, I was a bit confused because I was like, are they actually performing the Shakespeare on bikes in the theatre? And Matt,
or is it set to the musical composer Handel? No?
Very good.
Yeah, thank you.
Tough room.
Yeah. Yep, thanks for the appreciation, guys.
What I was told is this, that the guys, there's four of them, and they travel around on bikes going to different venues performing Shakespeare, and then the bikes somewhat make up a part of the set. But I will be able to bring you more information on this weirdness next week on the show, because I'm going to go along to see. I'm going to try and get to see Macbeth, because I love Macbeth, and I'm going to do a little bit of a review and maybe chat to the guys after the show when I go.
And we've made Twitter friends with them, so we're hoping to do some kind of secondary school style student exchange with our cast and theirs. But it's at Battersea Park from the 6th to the 10th of May, and all the information will be on the Wandsworth Fringe website. So if you just Google Wandsworth Fringe, then you'll be able to find all of the information on this show and plenty of other things that are happening as part of the Fringe.
Yes. I feel like it's at the Pump House Gallery, actually, which I've not been to. Have you been there, Ellie?
No, I haven't. It is. I hear it's a very nice space.
Yeah. The other thing that's happening is Suburbere, which we plugged on our show a couple of months ago, maybe a month ago, just in the lead up to WAF, hashtag WAF chat. This is happening on May the 10th at the Bedford in the theatre room there, which is...
It's in Balham.
In Balham, yes, yep. I've seen some comedy. It's May the 10th. It's also going into June and July as well. But I feel May the 10th show is the show that's part of WAF.
It is indeed. And you can follow them at
Suburbere.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, it's like cabaret, but, you know, suburban.
Yeah, it's so many bees, my mouth got overexcited.
I'm gonna actually tweet a photo of their flyer, because it is fantastic. It's one of the reasons, that I went up to this guy and started speaking to him.
Yeah.
Because I was like, I really like your flyer.
It's a very cool flyer.
It's got some nice cartoony stuff going on it. Matt, you're seeing something this week, I feel?
Yeah, so I'm seeing most of the... I saw pretty much everything in Nicholas Heitner's last season at the National, final season. He's stepped down. And I'm seeing most of the stuff in the new season as well. So what's coming up this week that I'm seeing is Light Shining in Buckinghamshire, which is Carol Churchill's new play, which is kind of set in the aftermath of the English Civil War, kind of as British politics was all kind of, as we know it, was taking shape. And I didn't plan this because I booked it so far in advance, but I happened to be seeing this play about British politics on election day.
That's fantastic.
I'll tell you about that experience next week.
Ellie, you got it? Well, Ellie actually doesn't have... I know that Ellie doesn't have anything coming up because Ellie's one of the busiest people in the world at the moment.
Yeah, while Alice is running at the Battersea Library, I'm pretty much just living at the library.
In Clapham.
Yeah, I'm living at the library, just sort of behind one of the bookshelves in the corner, covered in books. They've actually sort of taken up residence not only in the library but also at the Battersea Arts Centre Scratch Bar.
Yeah, we're spending a lot of time.
Yeah, I had a full English there yesterday, which was delicious, and then also drinks after the show.
I noticed that in the kids section of the library, where you kind of wait to go into Alice, there is a train. So maybe you can use that to commute back and forth to the library.
Yes, or just as a bed. Just take a blanket, knit a blanket of books.
Oh,
cozy,
so,
down,
so comfy.
So comfy. But it's been fantastic fun. We had our get in tech and dress on Thursday when the library is closed to the public, and that was a whirlwind of military precision organizing because we had 6 hours to do the whole thing. And we opened on Saturday yesterday, did two shows, and they both went fantastically, and we in fact sold out our first show. So if you want to make sure that you can attend the show, then you need to go to blackshawonline.com and purchase advance tickets. They're only £6 for adults and £3 for children. And we've got two shows tomorrow, one at 3 and one at 4. And there's several other dates running up until the 16th of May.
Yes, and we'll chat a little bit about buying tickets and how you can reach us after we play you our trailer for Alice.
Tell us a story, girl. Tell us a tale. The hare doesn't have much of one, and the queen chopped the mouses off.
Oh, the queen! The queen! Where is she? Where is she?
Now look what you've done.
Alice!
How doth the little crocodile improve its shining tail? And pour the waters of the Nile on every golden scale.
We're all mad here.
How cheerfully it seems to grin.
I'm mad.
How neatly spreads its claws.
They're mad.
And welcomes little fishes in.
You're mad.
With gently smiling jaws.
Alice!
Stop laughing, that wasn't funny.
I thought it was, but then I find most things funny.
Fall down the rabbit hole with Alice as her world is turned upside down in this new adaptation of Lewis Carroll's classic Alice in Wonderland. Suitable for ages 4 and up and plenty of jokes for the grown-ups, adapted by Richard Stratton and produced by Blackshaw Theatre Company. On at Battersea Library from the 2nd to the 16th of May. Tickets are £6 for adults and £3 for children. Available now at blackshawonline.com.
That is the silliest thing I've ever heard, and I won't believe it.
That was our trailer for Alice in Wonderland, which is occurring at the Battersea Library in Clapham. And there's also something else coming up that we're doing in the next couple of weeks as a part of WAF, which is a Blackshaw New Writing Night.
Yes, the big New Writing Night.
Big.
Yeah, we are, for I think the first time ever, transferring our New Writing Night away from the Horse and Stables, which is our regular home for the New Writing Nights, to the Selkirk in Tooting as a special WAF one-off. And we've got some great pieces that have been selected from some local writers, which is really great. And it's on Sunday the 17th of May at 7:30 p.m. at the Selkirk, and tickets are only £4. You can buy them in advance at blackshawonline.com, and we'll be announcing all the pieces that are being performed in the coming days. On Tuesday, in fact, I'll be doing a blog post.
Yeah.
So listen to next week's Blackshaw Arts Hour, 6 till 7, and head straight out to the Selkirk for 7:30.
Yeah, immediately.
Yeah. If you live close enough.
Yes.
That's what we'll be doing. Oh, that's fun. I like that. So tune in next week. We are going to, I'll be hopefully reviewing Macbeth by the Handlebars, which we just spoke about a little bit before, which is a part of the Wandsworth Fringe. Most of our shows for the coming weeks up until the Fringe finishes are very centred around what's happening in Wandsworth. In the arts sort of zone.
And if you want to keep up with what's happening as part of the Fringe, you can follow at W Worth Fringe, which is the main Twitter account. And you can also follow us at Blackshaw Update. We'll be tweeting about our shows and other shows and all the backstage gossip and lots of pretty pictures.
Yes, I think we have some backstage cool rehearsal stuff next week to play for you as well after for Alice.
Excellent.
Yeah, so tune in next week. Thanks for joining me, guys, again. You're lovely.
No worries.
It's always
Thanks
lovely.
For having us again.
Yeah.
That's okay. Yeah. Listen in next week. We'll be here again.
Bye.